because the way it works, it listens to the uplink signal that you transmitted to it. It divides it by the ratio 240 over 221, 221 over 240, that rational number of division. You divide the frequency and send it back down. In other words, the signal that you hear back down is a function of the frequency you sent up in the Doppler shift, which is calculatable. So you can literally count every cycle of what comes back down compared to what cycle, how many cycles you sent up. And you can therefore get extremely accurate range rate information and range information out of that very fancy design of a Doppler, transponder system. It essentially does not use a crystal on board. It just listens to your signal, divides it by the rate ratio, multiplies it by the rate ratio, and sends it back to you. You know exactly how much frequency shift is going to be compared to what you sent up and what you sent down. The example I had is that when I listened to the Apollo astronauts on Apollo 15 and 16, let me drop. That ratio of 240 over 221 means that the downlink signal was 2287.5 megahertz. That was the downlink frequency. You divide by that ratio, and you know the uplink was 2106.4. 2106.4 megahertz was what NASA sent up to Apollo. 2287.5 megahertz is what came back down. A very well-known ratio, 240 over 221. I found out about that, and the magic of finding about that is that when the Apollo 15 or Apollo 16 was in orbit around the moon, the command service module is in orbit around the moon, the lunar module had gone down to the surface. I know that the world's biggest dish, so to speak, a 240-foot Goldstone dish with 10 kilowatts of power, is transmitting the uplink to the satellite to make sure, the Apollo spacecraft, to make sure that they get a good, strong signal. I knew that 99.99% of that signal was going to miss the satellite and strike the moon and reflect off the moon and come back down. So because I was using a synthesized receiver on the ground with my 12-foot homebrew dish and the spectrum analyzer I was working on at Airborne Instruments Laboratory at the time, I listened to 2287.5. I could hear astronaut audio. If I tuned to 2106.4, I could listen to the moon bounce echo of the uplink. I could hear both sides of the conversation. And that was darn interesting. At the time, the astronauts were at the end of their mission, at the end of each one of their sessions during the day before they went to sleep. Let me drop. At the end of each one of their shifts, they would read up to them the news of the world as to what's going on in Germany and Vietnam or whatever. They would read them the news, and the astronauts would sit there quietly and said nothing. Then they would read them the scores of the Houston Astro baseball team, and you hear them cheering. They cared about what the Houston Astros were doing, but what the rest of the world was doing, they were essentially uninterested. I was listening to both sides of the conversation. And I eventually discovered I didn't even have to wait for the moon bounce. Because the way the transponder worked on the command service module, 2106.4 uplink, 2287.5 coming back down, there was a little bit of the signal of the uplink leaking directly into the downlink as a side lobe. So by listening to the undesired side lobe coming out of the transmitter, I again could hear the command service module. I could hear the uplink and the downlink simultaneously and compare what they were being told versus what was their response. Real interesting project, as you can tell. That was way back in 1971 during Apollo 15, and I guess it was later on that year there was Apollo 16 that I was listening to these guys. And I was listening to them at times when they were not connected to the networks, when they were not doing a news conference, so to speak. So therefore, I at times heard some rather interesting semi-private conversations. And I remember sending a letter to NASA saying, hey, by way of the Communication Act of 1934, which is controlling interstate communication, am I allowed to say what I heard? And NASA didn't have a nice, clear answer for that. I could tell that they knew I was going to use good taste and not transmit anything that was embarrassing, so to speak. but there was no clearly defined FM repeater.
Time out.
There was no clearly defined FCC rule as to what I was allowed to repeat as to what I was hearing. Was I doing wiretapping? Could I be accused? Could I be could I be prosecuted for doing the equivalent of wiretapping because I'm listening to the astronauts and telling the world what I heard? And so there was no clearly defined law at the time when I was doing that, as you can tell. As I said, I used good taste. So to me, those are rather interesting conversations. I can remember Mattingly, Young, and Duke on Apollo 16 discussing who was eating the most amount of food and how is it floating around the cabin, and they were grabbing it with their mouth, and the flatulence they were getting from the Tang orange juice that they were drinking, discussing some of those kind of things. And so that was about the most embarrassing thing I think they said. Turns out that during the time that the Earth was rotating and I was on the backside of the Earth, I couldn't hear the astronauts, but Darmstadt, Germany is where the guys, I guess it was Gunter Hock, I think it was, his group was using a radio telescope, and they were listening to the astronauts, and they did hear some strong force, four-letter words being used when something went wrong with some of the equipment, and they, what they were doing in Germany is taking the downlink audio of the command service module and retransmitting it on FAA frequencies, on the pilot frequencies. And so, because they weren't carefully monitoring, so to speak, some of the four-letter words got out and were broadcast in Germany during the Apollo 16 mission. But you guys would be kind of curious about that. But you did have to calculate the Doppler shift. And what I did, as the command service module was going around the moon, let me drop. And they were going around the moon in a clockwise manner, view, top view, from north. When you're above north and you look down, they were going around the moon in a clockwise manner. As such, when they went around the moon on the left-hand side, I heard negative Doppler shift. When they come back around again from the right-hand side, I would hear positive Doppler shift. Another interesting thing I was able to do is that as the command module went around the moon on the left-hand side, going around the moon clockwise, the moon itself was casting a shadow onto the Earth. That shadow was wiping across the Earth, starting on the west coast toward the east coast. So in other words, as the shadow of the moon, when they were going around the moon on the right-hand, on the left-hand side, clockwise, as the shadow swept across the Earth, Goldstone, California, lost communication, loss of signal as that shadow swept across the Earth. I, on the east coast, on Long Island, was still hearing the astronauts. And therefore, I heard them at times when they lost the uplink. And I discovered a little bit more about how the system works. The way the system works is it's got a search mode. If it loses the uplink signal, the transmitter sweeps across a particular frequency range looking for that uplink signal. So I heard the signal sweeping across my receiver as a swish, 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 so to speak. That's about the rate at which the search engine on board was looking for the uplink signal that it had just lost because of the shadow wiping across the Earth, and I'm still listening to the downlink signal. So I was hearing them, oh, I'm not quite sure I could calculate it. I'm guessing I was hearing them about 20 or 30 seconds longer than Goldstone was. I know I've got off to a crazy subject that you didn't ask about, but it's related to Doppler. And some of the guys, for instance, W4HHK in Tennessee, he did a careful plot.
Repeater, time out.
Must be something wrong with the link up because I can't hear the New England TechNet.
Fine, I was listening to it before you cut in.
Okay, whether or not, let's see now, I'm hearing the Eastern Link. I know there's a link between the Eastern Link on Long Island and the Western Link, which is the one I'm using right now, and right now they are connected. So, what I was finally going to say, Paul Wilson, W4HHK, he and I co-authored that article in 1972 called Houston, This is Apollo, in which we described some of this. And what Paul did was, he would carefully plot the exact carrier frequency as the command module went around the moon. And by looking at that characteristic S-shaped curve of Doppler shift versus time, you could tell exactly where he was in that orbit going around the moon, if you know what I mean, between acquisition of signal and loss of signal. It traced this very characteristic curve of Doppler shift. And by looking at that frequency versus time, you could immediately tell how high above the moon was that satellite, because as you change the altitude above the moon, the amount of time it takes to go around the moon changes, your velocities change, the characteristic S-shaped Doppler curve gives you a lot of information. So by looking at that curve, somebody could tell you, hey, it's a secret as to how high they are, how fast they're moving, and what object they're going around. And if you look at that characteristic Doppler shift curve versus time, and you know what you're looking at and you properly analyze it, you can figure out everything about that satellite. What is the ellipticity of orbit? What's the inclination of orbit? What's the altitude of orbit? What's the velocity? How much gravity is the object they're going around, and so on. You can know everything except the mass of the satellite itself. That wouldn't be there, if you know what I mean. Let me drop this. So as you can tell, there's a lot more to radio than first meets the eye. There's only 25, 26 different kinds of ham radio, and you start looking at all of these beautiful electronic systems that people like NASA are using in order to communicate with the Apollo spacecraft, the Voyager spacecraft, the Hubble Space Telescope, and so on. There's a lot more to radio than first meets the eye. There's one other person here that signed in. Let's see if we're able to hear him, and that was Mike. Kilo 1, Mike, Juliet, Mike. Are you there, Mike? K2LIW on the TechNet.
K1MJM, yep, this is Mike, I'm here.
Then go right ahead with your question, Mike.
All right, Dick, thank you. This may be a little bit deep for a TechNet, but I'm looking for information on transverters. I'm helping a local organization here pick a couple transverters, 1.2 and 2.4 gigahertz transverters for a satellite tracking, satellite communication. We have a TS-2000 transceiver, and I talked to a Down East Microwave for quite some time. Let me drop for a second. I spent quite a bit of time on the phone with Down East Microwave, and they told me quite a bit of information, but not really enough to get me going. They mentioned disciplined TCXOs and stuff like that, and I was wondering if you can give me just a quick once over on the more of the hardware end of it, not so much the theory end of it. Like I said, maybe a little bit too much for a TechNet, but I'll leave it up to you. K1MJM listening.
A darn good question, Mike. And one of my philosophies in life is that no frequency is high enough. As you go higher and higher in frequency, ham radio-wise or whatever, you'll make more and more discoveries as to the way radio really works and interesting ways of using it. And so when it comes to so-called transverters, the guys that are doing ham radio on 1.2 gigs, 2.4 gigs, 3.3, 5.6, 10.4, 22, 44, 88, 120, these are all ham bands, 120 gigahertz, 243 gigahertz. As you go to those higher frequencies, the easiest way to get there is by way of transverter. A transverter consists of a crystal-controlled oscillator and a mixer, taking your ham radio transmitter, like, for instance, 144. 144 megs is one of the most popular IF frequencies to operate a transverter. Right now, you're listening to 146.85. I could, in theory, take the 146.85 out of this transmitter, make sure it's going through the right kind of a attenuator so that the signal is down to, let me pick a number, 10 milliwatts is the usual amount of drive power. Put that 10 milliwatt signal with all of its modulation into a transverter. The transverter mixes it with that temperature controlled oscillator, usually, not always. Let me drop. You mix it with the right oscillator, and out comes 1200 megs, 2400 megs, 33, 44, 10 gigs, whatever frequency you want. By doing uplink transverting, It's called a transverter because you use the exact same oscillator and the output of your low power transmitter on 144 megs or 432 megs. You mix up to the higher frequency on transmit. The signal that you receive, you mix it with the exact same oscillator and mix it back down. So I could transmit on 144.1, and that comes out at 1296.1. I receive 1296.1, gets mixed with that exact same oscillator, and comes back out at 144.1. So my normal all-mode transceiver becomes a beautiful tunable IF strip for this transverter. The transverters, there are a couple of very popular brand names, Down East Microwave, CUNY Microwave, and Microwave Modules are some of the very popular brand names of transverters. If you go to a particular website, you'll be amazed at the amount of information you'll find on this exact subject. Mike, stand by for a second. Mr. Microwave, the guy who for a long period of time held the distance record in the United States for the 120 gigahertz band, is a good old Dr. Tom Williams. Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Juliet Alpha. You go to the website of www.WhiskeyAlpha1MikeJulietAlpha.org. I think it's .org and not .com. You go to that particular website, and that is a introductory page to Microwave. If this guy's a real evangelist, if you know what I might know, you know what I mean. He likes to get more and more ham radio operators on the microwave frequencies. You go to that webpage, he'll give you a hell of a lot of information on the first page. You go to the appropriate thing that you can click on that page, and he will list all of the other websites that give you information. You start studying that webpage and the other pages he refers to, and it is an encyclopedia. You will get a tremendous amount of information. Good old Tom Williams had the good taste to also put something in there by K2LIW. At the bottom of his first page, you'll see an article about how to properly tune a dipole to get perfect impedance match, whether your dipole is in free space or part of a Yagi antenna. And so the curves, the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, and the 1,500-word article describing that is also on the bottom of that page. So Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Juliet Alpha, .org. You go to that website and you start digging into what he's got, and you look at the auxiliary pieces of information he's got. And as I said, it and all the information he's referring to is an encyclopedia. It'll tell you almost everything you want to know, and we're afraid to ask Mike. Kilo 1, Mike Juliet, Mike, K2LIW in the TechNet. N2MH. MH recognized, but Mike first. N2K1MJM, go ahead.
Excellent, Dick. Very good. Thank you very much. I had not been able to find that website. I will go look for it now. I came across a lot of other information on transverters, but most of it was, you know, people trying to sell you stuff, and most of it is outdated. There's very few available right now. It's all older information on the Internet. So I will look at this website here that you sent me to, and I guess that'll carry me over for a while. Thank you very much, Dick. K1MJM, back to you.
And Mike, your subject is so darn interesting, and it's one of the subjects that I'm very interested in. You're allowed to come back as many times in the future weeks and ask more questions. As I said, you're looking for Dr. Tom Williams, Williams spelled in the conventional manner. There's a slim chance that I've got his call letters wrong. Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Juliet Alpha. I'm pretty sure that's his call letters. But now that you know that it's Tom Williams and his various ways, you'll find that website. And I'll be correcting it in the next hour or so. I'll be double-checking. November 2, Mike Hotel. Did you have a further question on that one? K2LIW in the TechNet. Start off with your name, sir. My name is Dick.
Yeah, K2RIW, N2MH. Good evening, Dick. My name is Mark, M-A-R-K, and we are in West Orange, New Jersey tonight. That's where we live. And correction, it's Mike Bravo Alpha. Your suspicions were right. It's Mike Bravo Alpha. And when it gets down to me, I have a question related to Doppler shifts, since that was the subject tonight.
Hey, Mark, you are a very, very nice guy. That you're willing to wait your turn, so to speak. And thank you for correcting me. MBA Mike Bravo Alpha. So Tom Williams, WA1 Mike Bravo Alpha. And WA5 Victor Juliet Bravo. There's a J in that one. When it comes to another one of my favorite websites that I send people to, that's good old Kent Britton, who has these articles on printed circuit antennas and how to make a very inexpensive, what I call a coat hanger wire antenna, where you get the most bang for the dollar on Yagi-like antennas for 6 meters, 2 meters, 432, and so on. Alrighty, the next person on the list, I think, is going to be Jim. Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Hotel Yankee. You got it, Jim. K2LIW in the Tech Net.
Hey, Dick. Today I just had a question about, I was building, or I was going to see if I could build...
I think Jim might be using his handy talkie, battery operated, and he either pressed a button and it jumped to another frequency, or the battery suddenly ran out. Too bad we kept Jim waiting as long as we did. He's listening to all the other things going on as his battery's running down. Let me send it back to Jim one more time. And if Jim doesn't come back, we'll go over to Mark and then come back to Jim. Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Hotel Yankee. Go right ahead, Jim. Did your battery fail? K2LAW in the Tech Net.
Not sure if you can hear me well, Dick. If you can't hear me, I'll switch to Echo Link.
I'm hearing you beautiful, Jim. You dropped out suddenly. Go right ahead. You got it, Jim. We're hearing you very well right now.
Okay, so I was building a 10-meter ground plane, or I was going to, and so I cut out 5 1/4 wavelength wires, and I got an SO239 connector, and I soldered the center pin to one of them, and then I soldered the four holes on the side of the SO239 connector, and I soldered the other ground plane, the radios to those, to the four holes. I was wondering, is that how you build a ground plane antenna?
It sure is, Jim. That's one of the conventional ways of building a quarter wave ground plane with that SO239 connector and three or four radials coming off the four holes of the connector, the center connector going to the radiator, as we call it, on 10 meters, where usually the radiator is a quarter wavelength long, and a quarter wavelength on 10 meters is around 8 feet. So 8 feet for the radiator and around 8 feet for each of the four radials would make a quarter wave ground plane antenna. And whether or not you build yourself on 10 meters, a dipole or a ground plane is your choice because it is similar amount of material in either case. A 10-meter dipole, a half-wave dipole, is going to be approximately 16 feet long, 8 feet of wire to the right, 8 feet of wire to the left, with your transmission line in the center. And you don't have to have it in the beginning, but I do recommend some form of a ballon, whether it be a poor man's ballon, a few turns of the coax held together with a tape or tie wraps near the center of the dipole, or a real balloning device. So I think it would be a bit simpler for you to build a dipole than a ground plane, but the choice is yours. But you'll notice that the size of the radiator, whether it's the right side of a dipole or the size of the radiator, let me drop. The size of the radiator in the case of a quarter wave ground plane, in either case, it's very close to the same size. Quarter wave to the right, quarter wave to the left on a dipole, or quarter wave up and quarter wave for the ground plane radials in the case of a quarter wave ground plane antenna. You can see now where the name comes from. And so that should work like a charm. And when you visit these various field day sites that you're going to see I guess it's June 22, I think it is, you'll see guys using things like this. Back to you, Jim. KD2BHY, K2LIW in the Tech Net.
Thanks, Dick. I just have one more question. I knew that would be a short one, and I have one more question. I was always very confused by impedance. I have the basic understanding of it, but I don't really know what it is. Can you give me just a basic idea of what it is?
Yes, I can, Jim. If I was building a transmitter and I was able to do what we used to do in the early days of ham radio, before they invented transmission lines or before transmission lines became popular, what a ham would typically do, because in, let me pick a year, 1930, your typical house in 1930 was made out of wood. The ham radio operator would be relegated to the attic of the house. On his wooden table in the middle of the attic, he built the transmitter. He knew he's building a half-wave dipole, and if, for instance, it's a half-wave dipole on 20 meters, he'd have 16 feet of wire going out the eastern window, 16 feet of wire going out the western window. Those pieces of wire would come together in the middle of the wooden table where he adjusted the transmitter, where he had the transmitter located. So the transmitter was right in the middle of the dipole, and there was no transmission line. That's the way guys often did it in 1930. And in that particular case, the next thing somebody would find out, when you're testing the transmitter, and you're testing the transmitter into a dummy load, if you're adjusting the transmitter for a so-called 50 ohm impedance, that means he's now got a, if he's building a 100 watt transmitter, he's got a dummy load that can tolerate 100 watts without getting too hot. And it might be a light bulb in some cases. In some cases, it was a 100 watt light bulb. And if the dummy load with his ohm meter measured 50 ohms from center conductor to shield on the input connector, we call that a 50 ohm impedance, and he adjusts the transmitter so that it gives maximum power into that particular resistor, 50 ohms. If he found out by some magic that his antenna was going to be 75 ohms, let me drop it. By some magic, he found out that his antenna was going to act like a 75 ohm resistor at its resonant frequency. He could have constructed that dummy load out of the right combination of high power resistors so that it measured 75 ohms. And he now adjusted the transmitter so it gives maximum power when it looks at a 75 ohm load. So as you adjust the transmitter, the tank circuit, the output impedance matcher, the final stage, so to speak, of the transmitter, there's a slightly different way you adjust it so that it gives maximum power into a 75 ohm dummy load, and a slightly different way you adjust it to give maximum power into a 50 ohm dummy load. We call that impedance. Well, that's the resistive component. In the real world, your dipole at its resonant frequency, by definition, resonance means you're at the frequency where it's exactly a half wavelength long electronically, and it acts like a pure resistor. You take that dipole, and you now feed it a frequency a little bit lower than its resonant frequency. The dipole will be still a 70 ohm resistor, but it now has a capacitance effect. It acts like your dummy load now had a capacitor in series with that center conductor. And so the combination of the capacitor and the resistor, we call that impedance. It's something you can represent mathematically on a Smith chart. You can write it down as an equation. Let me drop it. Whenever you describe the impedance of something, the impedance always has two terms. The first term is the resistive term. The second term is the reactive term. If my particular antenna at my frequency acted like it had a 50 ohm resistor in series with a 10 ohm capacitor, 10 ohms of capacitive reactance, I would say that the impedance of my antenna is, open parentheses, 50, comma, J10, close parentheses. That's the way it's usually written down. That crazy nomenclature is telling you that the resistive component is 50 ohms, the capacitive reactance is 10 ohms, that's some number of microfarads at that frequency, and that's the total impedance. Every real device has a certain amount of resistance and a certain amount of reactance. Reactance means it acts a little bit like a capacitor or a little bit like an inductor. The combination of the real part, open parentheses, 50 ohms in my example, comma, J50, J10 in my example, close parentheses. The J means the reactive component. The positive 10, I should have said negative 10. Negative 10 would be a capacitor. Positive 10 would be an inductor. So whether the polarity of the J component of the impedance, whether it's positive, it means inductor. Whether it's negative, means capacitor. It tells you how much of capacitive action you've got or inductive action with the resistor. The first time you hear this, it's not going to make sense. At first, you just memorize it, so to speak, Jim. Hear it a lot of times. When you read the early chapters of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, let me drop. When you read the early chapters of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, it'll make it a little bit more easy. The word impedance, a lot of people have trouble with it. The fact that it frustrates you, don't worry, you're in good company. You'd be amazed how many years downrange in my engineering experience it took before I had a more thorough understanding of what all this really meant. So memorize the words for now. It's not going to make a whole lot of sense at first, but it will eventually make more sense. There's a lot more to it than I've told you so far, Jim. You're allowed to come back each week and ask more questions on this subject, because I think half of the audience is having trouble with it. You're not alone. KD2BHY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Thanks so much. I had the basic understanding of it, but I never really completely understood what it was, and that really helped out. I think I'm going to read the first chapters of the Amateur Radio Handbook, and yeah, thanks so much for that answer. Back to you.
Yeah, the next step in the understanding, you'll find out, is that the resistive component is the so-called in phase. In other words, if I send a signal down a transmission line, it's a 50-ohm transmission line, and if at the end of the transmission is a pure 50-ohm resistor, I call the transmission line 50-ohm impedance, because when it has a 50-ohm pure resistor at the far end, the signal flows down the transmission line once, all of it gets absorbed at the far end, none of it reflects back. If at the far end the resistive component is higher or lower than 50 ohms, some of the signal is going to reflect back in phase or out of phase. If at the end the load is a little bit capacitive or a little bit inductive along with the 50-ohm resistor, that's going to give you a 90-degree phase-shifted signal, positive phase shift or negative phase shift, 90 degrees. The reactive component gives you a 90-degree phase shift. The resistive component gives you a 0 or 180-degree phase shift. 0 degrees phase shift if it's greater than 50 ohms, 180-degree phase shift if it's less than 50 ohms as a load on that transmission line. So by looking at the nature of the signal that reflects down the transmission line, by measuring how strong is that signal coming back down, we call that standing wave ratio. That's a fancy way of telling you how much impedance mismatch there was at the far end. That's magnitude. Looking at the phase angle of what comes back, if you're smart enough and you know exactly where the end of the cable is, that tells you exactly what the load is. It tells you whether or not it's capacitive or inductive and how much when you measure the phase angle. That's what a vector network analyzer does. It looks at the reflected signal on the transmission line, measures how strong it is, measures the exact phase angle, and by way of repeater, time out. And by way of the calibration of the vector network analyzer, once you measure that phase angle of what comes back and how strong it is what comes back, that gives you a dot on the Smith chart, and the exact location of the dot on that Smith chart tells you everything you want to know about that load. It tells you the exact resistive magnitude, the exact reactive magnitude, and whether or not it's inductive or capacitive on the reactive component. It tells you everything you want to know. So the word impedance, I'm going to warn you, there's a number of associated words that are going to confuse the hell out of you. Impedance, reactance, conductance, susceptance. There's a whole bunch of words describing the nature of that load. Impedance is the easiest one to learn at first. That's the resistive component and the reactive component. When you're making an equivalent series circuit of a resistor and a reactor, as the load, the representation. For every load in the world, there is a parallel equivalent. The parallel equivalent is a susceptance and a conductance. And now you're talking about the inverse of impedance, and all of a sudden I can't think of the word for it, but there's a bunch of associated words.
Admittance.
That's the right word, admittance. Admittance, impedance, susceptance, conductance, reactance. There's a bunch of similar sounding words. At first it'll confuse the daylights out of you. Just study impedance, resistance, and reactance. That's 90% of what you need to know. And at first, it's going to be a little bit hard. But you're allowed to keep coming back on that one, Jim. It's a good one. We're going to go over to Mark next. N2 Mike Hotel. And I bet you your last name begins with an H, Mark. And that's why you've got that beautiful set of call letters. N2 Mike Hotel. K2LAW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Mark. K2RIW, this is N2MH, and your observation is pretty correct there, Dick. It does begin with an H. And I've had those calls probably for over 40 years now. And I kind of like them. They grow on you. Anyhow, my question for you. Earlier tonight you were talking about Doppler shift. Well, I'd like to pose another question about that has to do with Doppler shift. It's a little different flavor. It has to do with aircraft reflections. We all know that if you're somewhere and you're hearing another station, you can hear a Doppler, sort of like a flutter, as the aircraft reflection gets close to your frequency. However, when you look at it on a spectrum analyzer, you notice that the Doppler shifted frequency starts high, drops down, goes through the frequency of the direct wave, and then continues on with a lower frequency. Now, I've also observed that the frequency always starts high regardless of the direction that the aircraft is flying between, in relation to you and the signal you're listening to. So my question to you is very simple. Why is that? It's quite possible, Mark, you've asked that question to just the right person. I'm going to tell you a mystery that I encountered. When I first set up my array of 16 Yagis on 432 megahertz on top of 100 feet of tower, each Yagi had 19 elements, 16 of them. That's 304 elements total. The 16 Yagi array was built into a bed spring. The bed spring was 15 and a half feet wide, 15 feet high, 13 feet from front to back. So this great big cube of antenna mounted on the top of a 100-foot tower with a rotator in the middle of it. And if you look at my QSL card, you Google the word K2RIW, you'll eventually find somebody who's got a website that's got a picture of my red QSL card. And on the right-hand side of that card, there is a photograph, a black-and-white photograph, of me standing in the middle of this 3,500 cubic-foot antenna on top of 100 feet of tower. So that antenna, 29 dB of gain on 432, allowed me to do some magic. Let me drop. I built it as a moon-bounce antenna, and I later intended to install an elevation control so I could tilt it up above the horizon to look at the moon. But I suddenly realized with 29 dB of gain on 432 and a so-called RIW parallel kilowatt amplifier that can put out 700 watts on sideband, I suddenly realized that with that amount of extra gain, I had three or four times the normal range. I had 10 or 100 times more area that I could cover with it. I found a total of something like 460 different guys I could talk to on 432 way back in the late 1970s. And in the process of picking that many brains, 460 guys, boy, I found all kinds of very interesting information. Anyhow, I eventually established a contact with a guy, K4CAW, Greensboro, North Carolina. He's 200 miles inland from the sea, 480 airline miles from me, and I'm talking to him on sideband one day, and I said, boy, that's a hell of a lot of mileage. My free space range to the horizon is 40 miles. You are 480 miles from me. You're 10 or 12 times my free space range, you know, horizon range. We don't know how the hell the signal was getting there. Turns out he's running four very good Yagis on the top of a 100 feet of tower and a kilowatt of power on his end also. Let me drop. So we said, gee, that is interesting. We calculate the range between us, and we said, how the hell is that signal getting there? All of a sudden, I've forgotten his name. Al. I said, hey, Al, this is Tuesday night. This is 7:30. We've talked from 7:30 to 8 o'clock. Let's meet next Tuesday night. Let's try it again. And next Tuesday night, we made it again. And to make a long story short, we eventually did this every single Tuesday night from 7:30 to 8 o'clock for 4.5 solid years, summer, winter, spring, and fall. And we made a lot of discoveries in that process of what really long range, over the horizon, forward propagated tropospheric scatter signals, what are they like? Okay. During a hell of a lot of those QSOs, that half hour QSO, I would hear a high pitched whine on his sideband signal. It slowly went to a zero beat. His signal got extremely strong during that period of time. Then it would slowly go from zero beat back out to a higher and higher note and disappear. We would hear that condition happen twice per half hour. And it kept us really going for at least 6 months or a year. We couldn't figure out what it was. I eventually looked at the airline charts, and I found out that there were a bunch of aircraft flying from New York to Florida. They flew directly over the midpoint between us, which was roughly Washington, D.C. They were 35,000 feet. They were in the mutual beam of his antenna from North Carolina and my antenna from Long Island. So the signal reflecting off the aircraft was giving us a tremendous amount of signal increase, 30 dB of signal increase, with this characteristic whine. And it was caused by Doppler shift, and I eventually figured out what's going on. The real signal between him and I, going over the near Earth, going over the ground wave, I'm going to call it, went by a curved Earth ground wave path between my Long Island location and his Greensboro, North Carolina location. Let me drop. That's the main signal. The signal by way of the aircraft reflection was a straight D-line between me and the aircraft, reflected off the aircraft, straight D-line from the aircraft down to him. So these two signals are beating against each other. That's the whine. Now what's the Doppler shift? I could make believe that there is a piece of wire going between me and the aircraft, and the other end of the piece of wire goes from the aircraft down to him. It's a bowstring. As the aircraft starts off, let's assume that the aircraft was way off to the west, where the bowstring is being really stretched a whole lot, and as the aircraft approaches the midpoint in Washington, D.C., the amount of stretch is decreasing. As the aircraft continues to the east, in my example, the bowstring gets stretched again. So you can look at the change of the length of the bowstring being plucked by the aircraft and compare that to the direct path flowing directly over the ground path between him and I. The difference in those two lengths is what created the Doppler shift. I've just given you an example of how the signal would have a positive Doppler shift as the aircraft start coming from the west and approached Washington, D.C. That's the bowstring getting shorter. Then it would have a negative Doppler shift as the aircraft proceeded from Washington, D.C. out over the Atlantic Ocean. The bowstring is being stretched again. Okay. By the same token, an aircraft that flies directly from New York City to Florida and flies over Washington, D.C., again, it's a bowstring being stretched by the aircraft. Let me drop. But now it's a more complicated stretch because the aircraft, as it takes off from New York City, is gaining in altitude, and it's stretching the bowstring in a funny way when your finger touches the bowstring, it's being slid along the bowstring, if you know what I mean. He's raising in altitude, eventually flying over Washington, D.C., and then down to Florida. So when you compare the geometry of a stretched bowstring by the aircraft flying through your environment between you and the guy you're talking to, you'll eventually see the difference in length of bowstring, the way it's being stretched, compare it to the main path, and you'll see where the Doppler of negative and positive is coming from as those path lengths are changing. Does that picture help make it a little bit more clear, Mark? N2 Mike Hotel, K2RIW in the TechNet. Yeah, K2RIW, N2MH. I understand what you're saying with the bowstring.
process that and understand how it goes from a higher frequency to a lower frequency, regardless of the path of the aircraft. I understand it is changing, but let's see if I got this right. The bowstring is one length that gets shorter at exactly midpoint, at which point you're dead on frequency, and then it stretches again and becomes lower in frequency. Now I got to run that through my processor here and understand that fully. In any event, I did find your QSL impressive array, and it looks like that little thing inside it is you. Is that correct?
You got it. That little guy in the middle of that array, with the hair being blown in the wind, is me, standing on the top of the 100-foot tower, in the middle of this antenna that wrapped around the tower. That's the array that talked to Greensboro, North Carolina. Now I'll explain where the zero beep's coming from. When he is flying from west to east, in this example, he starts off at the latitude of Washington, D.C., but he's directly west of Washington, D.C., and the signal out of my antenna, the side lobe of that signal, is beginning to reflect off the airplane. And the reflected signal is then going down to Greensboro, North Carolina, when I'm transmitting. So your bowstring is at maximum stretch when he's off, far off to the west, but he's just barely entering the beam width of each of our two antennas, these flashlight beams aimed at each other. He's just entering that reactive area, and that bowstring is at the maximum stretch. As he heads toward Washington, D.C., the midpoint between us, the bowstring is getting shorter and shorter. When he's directly over Washington, D.C., the bowstring is as short as it's ever going to get. The rate of change of the bowstring goes to zero. It's going from stretch to zero stretch, and it's about to be stretched again when he goes east of Washington, D.C., our midpoint. The zero beat is when the airplane is over Washington, D.C. It was being stretched maximum when he was off to the west, and it's going through smaller and smaller path length, less and less stretch, as he approaches Washington, D.C. That's starting off at a high pitch and getting to a lower and lower pitch because he's going to a rate of change of length of the bowstring that goes to zero when he's over Washington, D.C. As he moves 1 mile east or west of Washington, D.C., when there's a 480-long-mile bowstring, essentially nothing has happened.
Repeater, timeout.
So he's directly over Washington, D.C. When he's 1 mile to the east or west of the midpoint, essentially nothing is happening. As he now starts flying out to the east over the Atlantic Ocean, he's starting to stretch the bowstring at a faster and faster rate because it's now, eventually, as he gets way far out over the eastern Atlantic Ocean, eventually the rate of change between me and him is going to be the velocity of the aircraft. The rate of change between the aircraft and the guy in North Carolina, again, is going to be the rate of the aircraft. So when he gets far off to one side, the rate of change is very high. That's a high-pitched note. But when he's directly over Washington, D.C., the rate of change goes to zero. That is the zero beat. That is where we heard tremendous amount of signal strength. And this event occurred roughly twice every half hour, because that's how often an airplane was flying from roughly New York City down to Florida. Does that geometry make a little more sense now, Mark? N2 Mike Hotel, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2LIW, this is N2MH. Yes, that makes a lot more sense. However, you did mention one thing that is maybe even more important than just the raw geometry. You talked about the rate of change, and what you said was that the rate as the aircraft approaches the midpoint decreases and then increases as you go along. But more importantly, one can get from that the slope of the rate is negative as the aircraft approaches midpoint and becomes positive as it leaves the midpoint. And it's the slope that determines whether you're high frequency or low frequency. Does that make sense?
I think you've got it. As he flies from the west toward the midpoint, the total bowstring length is getting shorter and shorter. That's positive Doppler shift. Yes, positive Doppler shift. Midpoint, you go through zero beat. When he flies further to the east over the Atlantic Ocean, the path is getting longer and longer. That's going to be a negative Doppler shift. So it starts off as a positive Doppler shift as he approaches from the west toward the midpoint, because the path is getting shorter. You go to zero beat at midpoint. Then as he flies out east over the Atlantic Ocean, it gets longer, and that's negative Doppler shift. So you can see now a little bit of the geometry of why, in the majority of scenarios, in the majority of the geometries, you see positive Doppler shift first, followed by negative Doppler shift later. And I think you said it the opposite way before, and I think, at least for this particular path between me and Al, K4CAW, this is what we experienced, Mark. N2MH, K2RIW. I forgot to wait for the diddly-doo there. Yes, now let's take it from east to west. The plane flies from east to west. I've noticed that the Doppler shifted frequency still goes from high to low through zero beat. And that can't be explained strictly in terms of geometry, because your bowstring is starting at a shorter length and becoming longer as you go from east to west, rather than the case of west to east, where it becomes long, becoming shorter. What is changing, what is the same, is that the rate, as you go from shorter to longer, going from east to west, I'm trying to talk through this at the same time, your rate of change is still that the delta change is still decreasing. So that means the slope of your change is negative. As you move away from the center point, your slope becomes positive, the rate of change becomes positive, and that will hold regardless of the direction of flight. And the reason it starts out high and becomes low is because of that delta. It's the slope of the bowstring change. Yeah, I think we've almost got it. And let me repeat, and now we do it in reverse, but still first, normal direction. Airplane is to the west of me, up to the midpoint, flying east. The bowstring is very long. As he flies toward the midpoint, the bowstring is being stretched less and less. The total length is going less. Negative length gives you positive Doppler. It's opposite of common sense. As the length becomes shorter, in other words, the number of marbles in the pipe is getting less and less, you see positive Doppler shift. As he flies from far out to the west toward the midpoint, I see positive Doppler shift. He hits the midpoint, I hit zero beat. He flies out to the east over the Atlantic Ocean. The path is becoming longer. Positive length delta, negative Doppler. So, as he started from the west, positive Doppler as he flies toward the center point, zero beat at the center point, negative Doppler as he flies out over the Atlantic Ocean. Now let's take an airplane doing the opposite. Airplane starts from the Atlantic Ocean. Let me drop. Airplane starts from the Atlantic Ocean, flying toward Washington, D.C., the midpoint. The path is becoming shorter, positive Doppler, zero beat over Washington, D.C. He flies out to the west toward the toward Colorado. The path is becoming longer, negative Doppler. So in both of these examples, whether he starts off to the west and flies to the east, whether he starts off to the east and flies to the west, in both examples, I see positive Doppler at first, zero beat when he's at the midpoint, negative Doppler as he flies away from the zero point. So whether he's flying east to west or west to east, it doesn't matter. What matters is the bowstring becoming shorter, positive Doppler, becoming longer, negative Doppler. The slope of the rate of change of the bowstring is the opposite polarity of the Doppler. Once you study that a little bit longer, I think it'll make some sense if I didn't get it backwards, Mark. N2 Mike Hotel, K2RIW in the TechNet. N2RIW, N2MH. Oh, I've got it. I've got it. And that will also hold for the case where the aircraft is flying directly in line between you and a station you're talking to. The bowstring still starts out long, gets shorter, then gets longer again. So that will still hold on that case. So I think you've explained it, Dick. Thank you.
Hey, John, sounds like we've got another satisfied customer. We're going to make a fortune here. Okay, I think we've answered most of the questions of the guys who signed in. And it's getting late enough that we should go over to the mailbag. Killer Charlie Tomb, Whiskey Golf Bravo. Go right ahead, John. What kind of crazy email have you gotten this week? K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, or everyone on the net. Heard back from our window shade antenna construction. I'm sure you remember that from 2 weeks ago. He made a change, and he'd like you to give him an idea of what he accomplished. Let me let it drop. Okay, if you remember on a window shade, roll-up window shade, he had put a 2-meter and a 440 antenna, one on each side, made out of foil. And he was having trouble tuning the 440. So what he did was he improved the ground plane. He removed the one that was existing, and he cut a new ground plane, which looks like a trapezoid. If you look at, say, the western elevation of a pyramid and take the top third off, that's basically what it looks like in the drawing. It's all solid, and it covers much more area, and that did improve the 440 antenna. Both of them are coming back with approximately the same numbers. But he doesn't realize what he did. I mean, he knows what he did, but he doesn't understand the concept of why that changed. Maybe you could help him out.
And if I remember correctly, he was using a miniature kind of coaxial cable that came to a connector, I presume, at the bottom of the shade. The piece of coaxial cable, I presume, was taped against the shade, came up to near the middle of the shade, where the antenna on each side, a 440 antenna on one side, a 2-meter antenna on the other side. And I think he was making the antennas in a quasi-quarter-wave ground plane manner. Center conductor went to the radiator that went straight up, and at one time on 2 meters, for instance, he had a pair of ground plane radials that went down at a 45-degree angle to the right and a 45-degree angle to the left. And so, as I remember correctly, the 2-meter antenna worked rather well, but he was having a lot of trouble tuning the 440 antenna. Let me drop.
You got it right.
And the 440 antenna on the backside was essentially parallel to the 2-meter antenna, and even though there's a shade in between the two, the RF doesn't see the shade. All it sees is that there's a 2-meter antenna an eighth of an inch away, much too close, and you're getting extremely close coupling. And so I was at first recommending that the 440 antenna be rotated in some kind of a way so that polarization-wise, it was different than the 2-meter antenna. And so the counterpoise for the 2-meter antenna was probably a little bit spooky. If I understand correctly, he's now made the counterpoise into a trapezoidal-like device. The trapezoidal-like counterpoise for the 440 antenna is acting a little bit like a shield. Even though it's small in wavelength compared to 2 meters, it is not affecting the 2-meter antenna very much, a minor perturbation, but it's now a more solid counterpoise for the 440. And still, I would try to make sure that the radiator on 440 is not parallel with the 2-meter antenna on the other side of the shade. If you tilted one antenna, rotated the whole damn antenna 45 degrees to the right on 2 meters and 45 degrees to the left on 440, you would, by way of polarization, decouple them a whole lot, and I'd recommend that. Now, when it comes to the 440 antenna, let me drop. As I've told you guys lots of times, we all think, by way of the diagrams we've seen in the training manuals, that the only way to set up a quasi-half-wave dipole is that it's parallel to the ground, straight, flat, not tilted in any way, fed in the exact center, and a small diameter of wire on both sides. We think that that's the only way to build a dipole. And as guys start building an inverted V or a V dipole. As they start zigzagging it and bending down the ends, they think all hell's going to break loose and it's going to stop working. They also think if they don't feed it in the center, bad things